Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Richard Montague from the Department of Justice Civil Division. I'm here today on behalf of DEA Task Force Officer Luis Dominguez, who is appealing a portion of a district court summary judgment ruling denying his defense of qualified immunity. The main issue presented here for the Court today is whether a law enforcement officer can be held liable in damages in a constitutional tort action for an asserted breach of the rule of Brady versus Maryland. The district court's determination that an officer could be liable in such a case was erroneous and should be reversed for three main reasons. First, the fair trial guarantee of Brady implements the constitutional right not to be deprived of life or liberty without due process of law. Without a conviction and criminal sentence, there simply is no liberty deprivation to complete the constitutional violation. Second, even if the district court had been correct and Officer Dominguez had violated the Constitution, the rule adopted by the district court was not clearly established. And in addition, a reasonable officer in the circumstances of this particular case would not understand that the information we're talking about was Brady. In other words, the violation was not clearly established. Your Honors, whether or not a Bivens action for damages, an implied cause of action, is an appropriate means to enforce the constitutional right in the circumstances of this case a Bivens action is not appropriate in the circumstances of this case.
Well, doesn't the fact that Bivens focuses on deterring wrongdoing by federal officers weigh in favor of recognizing a Brady claim here despite the acquittal? And I realize Judge Holderman was plowing new ground with this decision.
It does not in the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, an officer who recognizes that he has information that is subject to disclosure under Brady and does not do so will be liable in the event that there is a conviction. And that's consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Agers, which emphasized that conscientious prosecutors or law enforcement officers in this context will disclose. So there is that deterrence element at work, even if an acquittal might result in a particular case, because the officer does not know pre-trial what the outcome of the case will be. So it's a pretty significant gamble to take that not to disclose the information, nor does it necessarily make any sense. I won't disclose this because he will be acquitted. The thinking is, well, I better play it safe and disclose this because if there's a conviction, it may be reversed and I may be liable. So the deterrence principle is always at work, and that's consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Agers and also with this Court's own decision in Newsom versus McCabe, which imposed liability in the case of officers who didn't disclose and there was a conviction.
With respect to the liberty interest, I understand that with acquittal he doesn't face the charge again, but there was an initial arrest, and was he released immediately on bond, or was there some period of detention?
According to the complaint, he was in custody for several hours the day of the arrest.
And then while on pretrial release, I assume there were some restrictions?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be affect his liberty interest?
That is not the yes, in a sense. Let me answer it this way. But it's not a Brady violation, and that's not the claim that we have here. I think the law is clear that when the police suppress evidence material at a given stage of the criminal process, there can be liability. For example, at the Fourth Amendment stage, an officer who seeks a warrant and knowingly or recklessly suppresses evidence, causes an arrest to happen, he can be liable. The same thing may happen if pretrial detention happens. But that's not a Brady claim. Brady focusing on evidence that is exculpatory with respect to guilt or innocence or impeachment material that would be used at trial. The focus at the pretrial stage, whether it be obtaining a warrant, seeking a grand jury indictment, what have you, the focus at those earlier stages is, for example, probable cause. And evidence that's exculpatory of guilt or innocence isn't considered. But That said, the suppression of evidence material to the probable cause determination would be a violation. But that's not the claim that we have in this case. That's not the Brady claim. It would not be a Brady claim. And indeed, there are claims in this case, Fourth Amendment search and seizure, or arrest claims, Fourth Amendment seizure claims, but the district court dismissed those claims.
There was a suppression, an identification suppression hearing at which this information about the fact that Dominguez had viewed a photo, that would have been helpful to the defendant at that hearing, wouldn't it?
Yes, that is the claim, that it would have been useful to have the information at that hearing. However, and the theory is, well, if Mr. Carvajal had had that information, then he could have prevailed in the suppression hearing, and there would not have been a trial. He would not have had to undergo a trial. But that also is not a Brady claim. That is a malicious prosecution claim. In other words, that's not a claim, I didn't get a fair trial. That's a claim, I shouldn't have had to have gone to trial. I shouldn't have had to have suffered the burden of defending myself, and that's addressed by the tort of malicious prosecution, which this court has said in Newsom is not a constitutional violation when there's a remedy under state law.
And then in terms of that claim, that malicious prosecution claim, just I know there were some other claims brought. Just remind me, was that filed here, a malicious
There was a malicious
But that was dismissed, wasn't it?
That's correct. The district court dismissed the claim both because the plaintiff had not shown absence of probable cause. In other words, he had not shown that there was a lack of probable cause for the initiation of the criminal case. He had not shown that a but-for cause of the initiation of the criminal case was Officer Dominguez's identification. And in addition, as the district court pointed out in dismissing that that claim, there was other evidence in the record which tended to point to Mr. Carvajal. Focusing on the liberty interest, the need for a deprivation of liberty in the form of conviction or sentence is consistent with Brady itself. Going back to Brady, the Supreme Court quoted the its earlier decision in Mooney versus Holohan as saying that due process, quote, cannot be deemed satisfied by mere notice and hearing if a state has contrived a conviction through the pretense of a trial in which truth is but used as a means of depriving a defendant of liberty through a deliberate deception. And that liberty interest focus, the need for a deprivation of liberty, also makes sense of cases such as this court's decision in Steidl versus Furman, which held that law enforcement officers who had nothing to do with the plaintiff's criminal trial in which evidence was suppressed, but who instead suppressed evidence during post-conviction proceedings, nevertheless could be liable. That makes sense. They had nothing to do. They couldn't have deprived the plaintiff of a fair trial, but they could deprive him of a liberty interest by interfering with the proper operation of post-conviction proceedings. So the focus on liberty interest as opposed to the more abstract notion of fair trial is consistent with Brady, with the Supreme Court's Brady decisions, and also is consistent with this Court's own cases.
So is your bottom line that an acquitted defendant can never bring a Brady claim, Brady argument via Bivens' claim?
If he is acquitted, no, he cannot bring a Brady claim. That is our bottom line, yes.
So the fact that he had to face the process, that is, go through the trial and ultimately get an acquittal, all the attorney's fees and everything attendant to that, you would say doesn't matter because his only recourse is malicious prosecution.
That's correct. As a matter of constitutional law, simply because, again, the need for a liberty interest, there is not a liberty interest in simply not being subjected to criminal litigation. Again, as I indicated earlier, if there is some loss of physical liberty attributable to a suppression of evidence by a law enforcement officer, that may be actionable, such as under a Fourth Amendment theory. But when the claim is, I should not have had to have gone to trial, the plaintiff must look to the common law tort of malicious prosecution, which is actionable against government officials under the Federal Tort Claims Act. In addition, the availability of that remedy, that's the constitutional issue, but the question of whether to imply a Bivens remedy takes a rather similar tack, Your Honor. The availability of this alternative remedy, this alternative process, in the form of a malicious prosecution action eliminates the need for the court to create a Bivens remedy.
Who would be the proper parties in this case for malicious prosecution would stand?
For a malicious prosecution claim, for a Federal Tort Claims Act malicious prosecution suit, it would be the United States.
We had a case just like this in state court, which came up, of course that was sued the county, but not the prosecuting attorney's office. And it was Brady, very similar facts, which just was heard last Friday. So it's a question in that case of who the proper parties were under the state law.
Here, the proper party, the Federal Tort Claims Act specifies that the proper party for any common law tort committed by a federal employee, which in this context Officer Dominguez was, is a suit against the government under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And indeed, there's a procedure for substituting in the government when an official is sued in his individual capacity, and that was done here.
Let me follow up on that subject, though, this other case that Judge Kaney referred to. If there were an action under 1983 for a Brady violation for an acquitted defendant, shouldn't there also be a parallel Bivens action against a federal actor?
No, Your Honor, not in our judgment. Assuming, if I understand your question, assuming there is...
If it were to be determined that that there could be a 1983 action for a Brady violation under 1983.
Interesting. No.
For an acquitted
defendant. Section 1983 is a statutory cause of action and represents Congress' judgment to make an across-the-board cause of action available for against state officials who violate federal rights. The Bivens cause of action simply is not that broad, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized the need to examine whether there's special factors counseling hesitation. For courts, because this essentially is akin to a kind of policymaking judgment, to perform as would a common law tribunal. That was the teaching of the Supreme Court's Wilkie decision. So the mere fact that there might be a remedy available, take the Section 1983 situation, an officer could be sued under Section 1983, despite the fact there is the parallel state law remedy. That's not the case the Supreme Court has indicated as recently as Wilkie. If there is a parallel state law remedy, Wilkie teaches that if that is an alternative existing process that's sufficient to compensate for the harm to the injury, that's enough.
Thank you for answering a bad question.
Turning to the qualified immunity defense, as an initial matter, the rule adopted by the district court simply was not clearly established. This is a question on which, as the district judge noted, he and his colleagues have disagreed. But even beyond that, taking the particular information that we're talking about in this case, a reasonable officer would not understand that this is something he was obligated to disclose. The asserted Brady information here is impeachment material, specifically that Officer Dominguez stated he met twice with money laundering suspects, one of whom he identified as Mr. Carvajal, but he did not know Mr. Carvajal's name and did not see his photo until some point after the first of those two meetings. Could have been before the second meeting, could have been later, but he says it wasn't before the first meeting. A different agent, Agent Hunter, testified in this case, well, if he had the name Carvajal and he had the photo, he possibly, as the district court put it in its ruling, would have given that to Officer Dominguez. So it's that discrepancy that is said to be impeachment material that could have been used.
And the photo was obtained about a week before the first meeting, wasn't it?
That's correct, yes. That's correct. Actually, Your Honor, I think it might even have been closer in time. I think the photo was requested about April 9th or thereabout, and the testimony was the Secretary of State of Illinois would have responded probably within a week. So that photo would have come along fairly close in time to the date of that first meeting, which was April 16th.
Well, I thought it was August 16th, but April.
The first was April 16th. April 16th and April 23rd. But even if one were to apply the Brady rule to a hypothetical adverse outcome to Mr. Carvajal, no reasonable officer would understand that the date on which an undercover officer first learns a name and first sees a photo of a potential suspect is Brady material or impeachment material, in that it would somehow, you know, so adversely affect his identification. There's just no logical correlation between a law enforcement officer and an experienced and trained law enforcement officer doing his job, uncovering information about suspects, investigating them, continuing to investigate them, and a lay witness, for example, someone who's who's mugged. It happens very, very quickly. There's just no logical correlation between those two things such that an officer would know that, well, I'm going to have to testify about this identification and a discrepancy. The fact that I may have seen the photo before I met the suspects somehow would make a difference. And even had the information been disclosed, in all likelihood, all it would have done is simply underscore that the investigation at some point around April 16th had focused on Mr. Carvajal. His name was coming to light because, for example, the cell phone used to set up the two money pickups was registered to his ex-wife. A car observed by surveillance agents at one of these operations was registered to his ex-wife. And also Agent Hunter testified that he recognized Mr. Carvajal during a later surveillance in July of 2001. Unless the court has further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cohen?
May it please the court, my name is Robert Cohen, and I represent the plaintiff appellee, Raul Carvajal. And I'm requesting that the court affirm the trial judge's decision denying summary judgment on Mr. Carvajal's Bivens action claim relating to the Brady violation, where the judge found that there was at least a material question of fact as to whether Officer Dominguez did not disclose exculpatory impeaching evidence prior to the trial in the case, and therefore denied Mr. Carvajal a fair trial. One of the things that I think is important about this case is that the crux of the entire underlying criminal case turned on the identification of Raul Carvajal by Officer Dominguez. Officer Dominguez is the only person in any report that we have seen in this case that identified Raul Carvajal as the person who participated in the money laundering transactions. He's the only person who testified at the suppression hearing that Raul Carvajal participated in the money laundering transactions, and he was the only person who testified at trial that Raul Carvajal was the person who participated in money laundering transactions. And that was true, even though these were two money laundering transactions that were set up by the government, where there were numerous agents conducting surveillance of the transactions. So there were a lot of agents watching the transactions, and then there were other agents who conducted surveillance, including Mr. Officer Hunter, who followed the person who was supposed to be Raul Carvajal. They followed this person and for a period of time. And there were no audio tapes, no videotapes, and no pictures taken of the transactions or the person who was supposed to be Raul Carvajal by any of the agents during either the transactions or the surveillance. So Mr. Dominguez's testimony and reports were crucial in this case. And Mr. Dominguez did not write a report where he stated how he identified Raul Carvajal. The only thing is he wrote a report on May 14th, 2001, where he talks about the April 16th and 23rd transactions. And in those reports, he says that he identified Raul Carvajal subsequent to those transactions. Then at the suppression hearing, again, he testifies that he wasn't shown photos before April 16th. He was shown photos after the transaction, possibly between the first and second transaction. He doesn't remember who showed it to him. He doesn't remember how many photos were shown to him. It wasn't a photo lineup, and he doesn't really know the details of that, but he's sure that it happened after the at least the first transaction. And he repeats that testimony at trial. Came out during discovery in the case that the evidence really indicated that that probably wasn't true. The
discovery in the criminal case?
In the civil case. They didn't know about this in the criminal case. In the civil case, it turned out that the Chicago DEA office had gotten what they call a comprehensive report after the of Ariella Carvajal, because they linked her phone number. They had a phone number that they were going to use the call to make the transactions. And then they asked the cell phone company to identify who the owner of that cell phone was. And this was on April 6th. They got back on April 9th the report saying it was Ariella Carvajal. So they ran a National Comprehensive Report, or NCR, which identified a lot of information about Ariella Carvajal, like her residences, the car she owned. And through that, because she used to be married to Raul Carvajal, they were able to see that they had co-owned some property and some automobiles, so they ran a NCR on Raul Carvajal. And then they did all that on April 9th. On April 9th, they also requested a photo of Raul Carvajal from the Illinois Secretary of State. And Agent Hunter testified that he was sure that they would get a copy of that photo within a week of when they requested it, and it would be a short time. Now, on April 16th, Officer Dominguez is given the assignment to go on these undercover operations. Both he and Officer Hunter testified that he would be given the information that they had because he didn't want to show up at a scene where someone might recognize him. So he was told, they definitely had Raul Carvajal's name, so he had to have been told that name. He had to have been given the photo. And
you don't contend it was misconduct for him to look at a photo before he went to the pickup?
No, absolutely not. I think the reason that information is clearly impeaching is because in his report, he says that he identified him subsequent to the transactions. And when he testifies at the suppression hearing and at the trial, he testifies that he didn't identify him or see any pictures until after the transaction, at least the first transaction.
Well, how important is all of that?
Well, I think it's very important because...
Well, and the reason I ask is, he got the result you would have wanted for him at trial even without that information. So how could it be material?
Well, he was extremely lucky to get an acquittal in this case because he had an office. This was a federal criminal trial. It was a very, very serious crimes, money laundering involving, close to $1 million between the two transactions. There was an officer working for the DEA who testified that he saw him on these two occasions and that he identified him as being the person. And the fact that in his reports, he says that he wasn't able to identify him until subsequent to the second transaction. That fact, if you couple that, if his criminal defense attorney had known that he had seen his picture and had his name prior to the first transaction, that would have been very impeaching to his statement in a report that he wasn't able to identify him until later.
So he could have gotten an acquittal and apology from the jury?
Well,
my point is, how material was that if he was acquitted regardless?
It's material to the question of whether he had a fair trial, and I think that obviously there was a liberty interest at stake here. And Carey versus Pyfus, which is case that is cited in the Cariocha decision, Judge Holderman relied on, which stated the reasons why a Brady claim should exist even if there's an acquittal. The point is that a defendant has a right to a fair trial.
Well, that's another Northern District of Illinois case, all right.
That's correct.
That's not doing much here.
Well, we don't have any ruling in the Seventh Circuit on that issue.
Right, nor any circuit that goes this far, right?
Well, the defendant has cited some cases. Mr. Dominguez has cited some cases in their brief. Two of them dealt with cases where there was no trial.
Right, though, but I'm talking about our circumstance and the rule you would like us to adopt and that Judge Holderman adopted.
That's correct, and that's why I was talking about Carey versus Pyfus, because in Carey versus Pyfus, which dealt with just a property interest, the court said that even though the plaintiff couldn't prove that they were suffered any real harm, that was a case that dealt with students who were suspended and weren't given a fair hearing before their suspensions. But then it turned out, at least in the posture it was in the United States Supreme Court, they were assuming that those students, even if they deserve to be suspended, and even if they had a hearing, it wouldn't have reversed that suspension. The Supreme Court said there was still harm done to them and that they didn't get the fair hearing that they were entitled to, and they were entitled to at least nominal damages. So there is harm in not being given a fair trial, even though you were acquitted.
So if the prosecutor would have brought the charges despite having this information, would there have been any actual prejudice to the plaintiff?
Yes, because
on this same theory that you've just advanced and that you talk about in the brief, the harm of going through the trial and the expense and
that's true, and also just the harm of our position is that you have a constitutional right to a fair trial, and whatever the outcome of that trial is, you still have a right to a fair trial. And Mr. Carvajal was denied a fair trial because he was denied this important evidence. I mean, it's not just any evidence. I mean, it wouldn't just be any evidence that would constitute a Brady violation. It would have to be evidence that raised to a sufficient height that it could affect the outcome of a trial and deny him a fair trial.
I guess I'm having trouble with the concept of what could be fairer for a defendant than an acquittal. That seems to be the ultimate of a fair trial.
Well, I think you have to distinguish between the outcome of the trial and the process of the trial. A trial can be unfair and you could get acquitted, or a trial could be fair and you could be wrongly convicted. So we're focusing on not the outcome of the trial, we're focusing on the fairness of the trial. And in this trial, it wasn't a fair trial because Mr. Dominguez didn't disclose that he was actually given a picture of Raul Carvajal and told this was the person who was going to be there before he arrived, and then identified him. That would have been important information to impeach what he said in his reports and what he said in his actual testimony at the trial and at the suppression hearing. And it's especially important in this case, where you have it was totally an ID case. He was the only person who identified him at the trial or at the suppression hearing. And counsel for Mr. Dominguez had made some mention of Wayne Hunter saying that he recognized Mr. Carvajal, but he said that at his deposition long after the trial, and he also said at his deposition that he didn't recognize him at the time of these undercover operations. And he was at the trial, and he testified. And even though he testified at the trial, he didn't identify Mr. Carvajal as the person.
These are great arguments for winning a reversal of a conviction. But to get back to Judge Tinder, he got the ideal result, that is, an acquittal, right?
He did receive an acquittal, but what we're complaining about is not being given a fair trial. It's still a Brady violation.
Then would you say then we shouldn't even engage in whether it's harmful or harmless error? Because, I mean, clearly the jury didn't believe Dominguez. You said he was the critical witness. He was the one that did the ID. So this additional evidence would have just made him even more believable, because clearly they didn't think he was believable. So we shouldn't apply that sort of traditional analysis, even if we give it to you, you know, it was there, it was a Brady violation. You know, we don't get to that next step. What's the prejudice? What's the harm?
No, I don't think a harmless error is the proper analysis. I think the proper analysis is, was this information impeaching or exculpatory under Brady? And when I think any court in a criminal, if there was a conviction, a court
would.
But
when we look at, just go back for a minute. When we look at Brady, though, and we look at the analysis, we always ask the question, what's the impact? What's the harm? Okay, there's a Brady violation, so what's the harm? I mean, that's always, you agree, that's always part of the.
Well, I think the question is, would it have substantially affected the outcome of the trial? Could it have,
right.
If the person, you're usually looking at that question in the case of a conviction. So you're saying, this person was convicted, would this information raise, you're not necessarily saying, would he have been acquitted if he'd had
right.
this information, but you're saying, was there a substantial probability that he would have been acquitted if he'd been given this information? I think that in a civil case, the analysis is very similar. The court's going to say, was this the kind of information that could have changed the outcome of this case? In other words, if he'd been convicted, would this information have led to a reversal of conviction under Brady? I think if that was true, then they would have a civil claim under this analysis, whether they were convicted or acquitted. And counsel for Mr. Dominguez, I think, misinterprets the district court judge's opinions somewhat when he says that they're actually applying a much different standard than you would apply in a criminal case. I think they really are applying the same type of standard as you would apply in a criminal case. They're not just saying any information that should have been disclosed leads to a civil claim under Brady. It has to be both information that should have been disclosed, but also information that rises to the level that it would create a substantial difference in the outcome of a case.
How late could the government make a disclosure, a Brady disclosure?
How late did they make it in this case?
How late could they legitimately do it without any...
I think under the case law, as long as it's before the trial, they probably could do it.
So any expenses or harm that might have occurred prior to the commencement of the trial really doesn't count, does it?
Well, I'm not sure once you have a Brady violation, that's the case. I mean, if there is a Brady violation, I think that there's at least nominal damages. What the damages are beyond that is really going to be a question of what the evidence shows in the case. There might be emotional distress damages. In the Carey versus Pifus case, the Supreme Court, I believe their analysis in that case was, you had nominal damages. We're not going to assume there are other damages, even though this deprivation didn't cause any real harm, outcome determinative harm to the person. But they said there could be evidence that showed emotional distress damages shown by the heightened unfairness of the proceedings or something like that. So there could be other damages. It also,
is it the false testimony that you're suing about?
No, it's not the false testimony. It's the failure to disclose what the actual circumstances of the identification were. It's the fact that he didn't disclose how he actually identified Mr. Carvajal. And with respect to the immunity issue, the question on immunity is, did the officer have a reasonable basis to determine whether what they did was wrong? And the Seventh Circuit has held in Newsom that an officer's under obligations under Brady are clear. And obviously, as counsel for Dominguez said, an officer doesn't know at the time they decide to disclose the information whether there's going to be acquittal or conviction. So the officer knows as much as he's going to know, and it's clearly established that he should have disclosed this information.
How is that clearly established? You know, for example, an officer runs a criminal record on a suspect before they go to a meeting or something like that. How does an officer know that they need to disclose the date they got that record, the date they reviewed the record, and so forth? How would an officer know that the date he looked at a photo was something he had to disclose?
Because in this case, his whole testimony at the suppression hearing in the trial was the identification of this suspect. And the whole suppression hearing, in fact, was about how did he identify this individual as being the person who was operating in these money laundering organizations. The fact that he had seen a photo and had his name before actually going to the undercover operation was obviously a key part of the identification process. And this was an ID case. So he would have known that this was important evidence.
And was he asked about what his investigation had been before the meet? You know, before he actually met him that first time, was he asked any questions about background or what background information he had?
By the criminal defense attorney. He was asked when he first, what photos he saw, when he saw the photos, and to describe, you know, the photo identification.
So in his response, what did he say?
He said he didn't see a photo until after April 16th of Raul Carvajal, after the undercover operation, either after both undercover operations or after the first undercover operation and before the second.
So your position is that he lied then under oath, or was it an omission?
Well, I think that he probably did lie under oath, but that's not this claim. I mean, that's not what we're alleging in this claim. That's what we're alleging is that he failed to disclose that information. I mean, there might be there's immunity for perjury. There's some exceptions to that, and that was litigated down below. But the we don't have to get to that issue, whether it was an omission or perjury. The real issue is, did he fail to disclose that information under Brady? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Montague.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll comment very briefly on Carey. Carey is essentially a damages case. It is not a case which establishes a rule for determining whether or not there is a violation of the Due Process Clause. In Carey, there was a deprivation of a property interest. The plaintiffs were suspended from school, and the school board defended essentially on the theory that it would have affected the deprivation anyway, therefore there should be no harm. And the Supreme Court rejected that theory because it would be intolerable for the government to deprive somebody of liberty or property, not give them a proper notice and opportunity to be heard, which is, of course, the bedrock of due process, and then to turn around and say, well, but we were right and we would have reached that result anyway. In some contexts, like retaliatory discharge from employment, there is a same decision anyway defense, so to speak, but not where due process is at issue, because then the opportunity or the right to prior notice and opportunity to be heard would be lost. So what Carey comes down to essentially is where there is a deprivation and it is effected without due process, deprivation of a property interest in that case, what damages are available, even though the deprivation would have happened anyway. There was a violation. It was a question of damages. Unless the court has anything further, we respectfully request that the decision of the district court be reversed. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.